Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our minds for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast number 183. We are going to go through, it's October, officially.
Yep, it's raining outside.
It's raining.
It's fall. It's cold. Yep. It's not cold yet, actually.
Everybody's wearing costumes.
It's raining, but it's still, it's Texas swampy out.
There are evil clowns everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, expect that on Halloween night. You're going to see more clowns than you have in a long time.
The world is awash in Babadooks. It is everyone's favorite spooky time of year.
I don't know what comic it was this week, but Tilo's looking at something that did have
Moonstruck.
That did have the gay Babadook.
Yes, it did. So October means a couple things for us. It means that we are starting our new Roundup charity for the month. Last month's Roundup was for Hurricane Harvey relief. We haven't done the total yet, but people were contributing quite a bit this, and I'm looking forward to seeing what our total was.
Yep.
We should have that for you next week, and it'll be up on the website before that. This month, we are donating to the Hurricane Maria Community Relief and Recovery Fund, which is governed by organizations like Puerto Rico-based Tala Salud, the G8 of Cano Martin Peña, and other local grassroots organizations to make sure 100% of the funds go to Hurricane Maria relief in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
So that is where our donations are going this month.
I think this is obviously a very good call. I hate that the world is so crazy right now that it's obvious who our donations should go to.
I was going
to
say the same thing. It's like, I'm glad we can give back a little bit, but at the same time, I would love to have a month where we could just say, donate to Austin Pets Alive.
Right.
Or an ongoing manageable problem
something
instead of always
not,
a crisis.
Yeah, a crisis, emergency sort of situation.
But we're going to do what we can, and we hope you guys will help us with that. If you don't know what the roundup is, basically when you're at the counter, if you want to round up your change to the nearest dollar or add a dollar or whatever, we put that in. At the end of the month, we match up to $100 of the contribution. We send off a check to the organization. DC Deck Building Tournament is coming up this Saturday. That's going to be from 1 to 4 p.m. I'm very excited about this. I'm hoping to actually play in this tournament.
Nice.
It's always fun. It's one of our favorite games. We're going to have a variety of different sets. So you can play some of the villains, you can play different heroes, and it'll be a fun time. If you've never played DC Deck Building, probably not the ideal way to learn. But if you've played it like once or twice, you're probably good.
Right. And if you, I would imagine somebody who might just want to watch it or something would also kind of glean some coolness from it, because it is such a cool game.
Yeah, and it's a fun game to watch. And yeah, if you want to learn, this is a good way to come and learn it. Gaming with Rogues is going to be Saturday, October 21st this month. That is going to be Unearth and Boss Monster, which have in common the same publisher. Unearth is a game of like artifacts, raiding artifacts, and you use little cards to show the places that you're raiding, and different dice to represent your raiders. And it's a really fun game. It is nothing like Boss Monster, but because we only have the one copy handy, and because it is like the same publisher, we decided to run both. So come out with us that night, play either Unearth or Boss Monster. And then our Halloween Comic Fest is coming up. That is Saturday, October 28th. We'll run that basically when we open until when we run out of comics or until about 7 p.m. There's some cool stuff this year. I know Runaways number one is out there.
Yeah, yeah.
So
we just got
Chilling
that in Mistress today.
Chilling Adventures of Sabrina.
Yeah.
There's a Thor by Simonson featuring like a Hela story that was really
cool. Yeah, it's sort of off to the left of actually being Halloween themed.
Yeah, you know.
But Hela's like the goddess of death, and Sabrina for sure works.
And in some ways, it's just meant to be sort of a second free comic book day.
Right, a little mini free comic book day.
It's never gotten the same attention for us, and as a result, like, we don't have as many comics, so come early if there's a specific thing you want, as always. We'll also have stuff from the last few years, and maybe some bonus stuff from Free Comic Book Day, but come in, get some free comics. If you have a costume, wear a costume.
Yep.
It'll be fun. It'll also be our weekend of Halloween, so it'll be a fun day to sort of celebrate the upcoming Halloween Fest, which is everybody's favorite holiday.
Halloween Fest?
Halloween Fest. That's what I'm branding it as.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Yeah, you can't trademark Halloween. Halloween Fest? It's the Rogues Gallery original.
I'd call it a Halloween Hoedown.
Ah, Halloween Hoedown. Good. And then finally, Ladies' Night will be on Saturday, October 28th, later that night. And it is the Spoopy edition.
Uh-huh.
That's what TLS branded it.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. I assume that they're going to, like, draw a pentagram and summon something, but...
Probably so.
I imagine they're going to talk about spoopy things and spooky things, and I don't know. There's not a graphic novel that night.
No,
right?
No. They may put on a scary movie.
They're probably going to put some Halloween decorations up, or Tila may already have done that.
It's just a fun,
by that time.
A fun night to come hang out with the ladies and the lady identified.
Yep.
And
spoop it up.
And spoop it up. Alright, news. So, start with the comic news, which is that they're making a miniseries called Old Man Hawkeye.
Yeah.
There's a spinoff. I didn't get a chance to read
it's
on this.
It's a prelude
spin-off from to Old Man Logan.
Old Man Logan. Yeah.
Hawkeye was, of course, if you've read Old Man Logan, prominently featured in the miniseries, if not the movie that it kind of inspired.
Right.
With Logan.
And the funny thing is, like, most of the articles I've seen are using a picture of like Hawkeye from the movies, though he is nothing like that Hawkeye, because they're trying to bring in the Logan viewers. Yeah. But anyway, in the comics, Hawkeye was like his blind driver.
He was blind, if memory serves.
Yep, and he was like his sidekick and his sort of the point of view character in some ways.
Yes. I believe he was, he did do the driving.
Yeah.
I forget how that worked.
He was driving the Spider-Mobile.
Yep. Yeah. So it's a 12-issue mini. It's going to be by Ethan Sachs, who wrote the Secret Empire Brave New World, which was the one about the Hydra Choir that I really liked. And the artist Marco Cicchetto from Captain Phasma and some of the Star Wars stuff. And basically, this is the story of him losing his vision, confronting something that happened to him personally 45 years ago. He's on his own hero's journey, forcing him into action. So it's sort of a last ride for Hawkeye.
Who was the writer?
His name is Ethan Sachs.
Okay, but not Mark Miller of Old Man Logan.
No.
Okay.
Which actually makes me happy because I didn't love Miller's take.
Yeah.
But the cover art has like a badass-looking, like a post-apocalyptic... maybe Dodge Charger or Mustang or something with like a blower on it and the grill on the front and all that stuff and seems to show Madrox.
Oh, that's interesting.
Maybe a gang of Madroxes.
Yeah, well, you know, they certainly played around a bit with the Marvel Universe for the original Old Man Logan, with given the presence of Hulks, Spider-Mobile, Hawkeye, and various.
Anyway, Hawkeye is one of my favorite characters, and I've gotten used to different interpretations of him, and so a 12-issue focusing on Hawkeye's last ride sounds right up my alley. So I'm kind of excited for this, even though Old Man Logan is not my favorite story.
You don't want Hillbilly Hulks, necessarily?
I don't necessarily need Hillbilly Hulks. all right. This is interesting. Amazon just announced that they're developing three series adaptations.
Pretty notable stuff.
One of them is Snow Crash, which is based on Neal Stephenson's novel, which I think is sort of a cyberpunk thing. Mm-hmm. Another is Ringworld, based on Larry Niven's 70s sci-fi book series that is like pretty much classic like space fantasy kind of thing.
Yep. And Snow Crash is also a fairly legendary cyberpunk story.
Yep. So it's about the pizza delivery man who is a warrior prince in the metaverse.
Sure.
So it's like, it's cyberpunkish. And sounds not unlike a less pop culture infected Ready Player One.
Right.
And then, most excitingly for us, I think, is Lazarus, Rucka and Lark's comic book.
Yeah, we've been talking up Lazarus probably for some years now, 4 or 5 years, however long it's been running, as the sort of almost post-apocalyptic Game of Thrones, you know, with fiefdoms ruled by is it half a dozen or less mega families?
Houses.
Is it 12 families?
I thought it was 12 families.
It could be. It's not a lot.
But yeah, like, and they, like, control the world.
Yeah.
And live in super secure compounds. Like, and most everybody else is, like,
a serf
or what they call waste, which is just, like, the drudge workers who are, like, you know, starving in massive numbers and stuff like that.
It says here, 16 rival families.
16. Huh? Okay.
Anyway, Rucka is writing and executive producing.
Which is cool.
And we've talked about this before, we thought this was a great for adaptation of TV.
Yep.
Well, aren't they doing a Lazarus role-playing game? Am I misremembering
that? They are. There's
that?
Green Ronin as a Lazarus RPG coming out.
So I'm
actually
like,
looking forward to that.
I feel like, I mean, Rucka has done a really good job of, like, you know, creating this world and fleshing it out. And
where's
I
the action figures? Rucka.
Well, yeah.
You could only get the Lazarus.
Where's the Sumsums?
where are the Lazarus Sumsums and blind boxes?
That's right.
I'd buy some of those, to be honest.
But I think we all were thinking, like, oh, in my head, I can picture how this would adapt really well.
Yeah.
And I think especially modern TV audiences would be primed for it.
Yeah.
It is certainly a concept that is highly, highly relevant to our times.
Yeah.
So, given the pedigree of everything involved, this sounds like it could be really good.
Dave, remind me, you never saw the movie The Nice Guys, right? Shane Black?
Correct.
Okay. But Nick hasn't.
I actually don't believe it exists, but I've... You keep insisting.
It does.
I feel like I've watched it about 12 times.
I showed you the Blu-ray, Dave.
Prove it.
I showed you a picture. You think that I got Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe to dress up and pull a prank on you.
That looked more like something that you put together in MS Paint in 10 minutes.
Anyway, for those who are not Nice Guys truthers, Shane Black had a movie called The Nice Guys. It was an action detective comedy set, action comedy, I guess. More action than comedy. 70s? It was set in the 70s.
Randy, did you say, is the tone broadly similar to his other movie, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang?
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
That's why I hesitate to actually call it a comedy as I think about it. It's more of an action movie with a little sense of humor.
And he does have a very good sense of humor.
Yeah. Anyway, it was really good. And so Fox has given a script commitment to a gender-swapped reboot called The Nice Girls.
A reboot of a movie that was only out a few years ago?
So here's the weird thing. This is a TV version. It's a TV series. It's a one-hour contemporary take, female take on the feature film.
Okay.
Which, here's the weird thing. If I were to describe what The Nice Guys is about, I would say, it's like buddy cop detectives, which is the most generic thing you could say about it.
Right.
Then I would say, okay, it's set in the 70s. Then I would say it's like, you know, Shane Black's sort of style. And then I would be like, oh, and it had Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe playing sort of mismatched detectives very well. Most of that is gone. The most generic element is the only thing that remains of the TV show. Yeah. It is a pair of mismatched detectives. I don't understand why this is called The Nice Girls. I don't understand how it is tied into this property in any way, because I don't know that it's going to bring that many people to the table. That's
right. It's kind of a cult movie anyway.
Now, here's the thing I just thought of. Yeah. Is there any possibility that it's actually a sequel? And
holy
it could be
crap.
It could be the daughter.
Oh, if that's true, that'd be the best thing ever.
If it was good.
Because his daughter, his daughter in the 70s is a cool character.
Oh. Actually is like the foil and one of the kind of leads in a way.
I wouldn't call it a reboot then, but they might just be using that term. But yeah, if it's his daughter and she's grown up to be a private eye with somebody else.
That would be perfect.
That'd be amazing.
And if they weren't thinking this way before, they should be.
Here's the thing. His daughter would be like 50 in 2017.
She'd be Russell Crowe's age.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Oh, man. If this is a pairing of, like, a 50-year-old woman and a 30-year-old woman as mismatched detectives in 2017, I am so on board. Anyway, I'm on board anyway. I love good detective stuff. I love stuff with a little comedy. You know, we talked earlier about, like, time. I don't watch Lethal Weapon on TV, but it's not because it's bad. It's just that I don't have time.
Yeah, no, I actually really enjoy it.
I'm curious to see what they do with this. I'm still weirded out by it.
Yep.
But I'm always for more private detective shows on TV. As you guys may know, my favorite show of all time is a private detective show. Mm-hmm.
What show is that? I don't know.
Oh, it's about dogs called terriers.
Okay. Nice.
Note to watch that.
A pair of dogs, terriers. You know what, Dave? You make a note of all the stuff to watch that I recommended to you. You also have to spend a year in a cave with a Netflix account.
It helps when all you need is to read the note. You don't watch the show, you just read the reminder note.
Yeah, the TV guide. You don't need the TV.
That's right.
Finally, the Russo brothers, who are doing everything, are also set up to produce a TV series based on the comic book Deadly Class over at Sci-Fi. This is a Image book. It is it's about sort of homeless teens recruited to become assassins, set in the 80s. I only read the first issue of this.
Yeah, I mean, I read the first trade. It was interesting in that it had a lot of avenues to explore, of, like, rival schools of assassins and things like that. So
I've seen people were pretty fascinated with it, but I have not read much of it.
I mean, it's got sort of the Remender flavor, so if you've liked any of his stories...
Dark and acidic takes.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Well, the Russos have also sort of taken up the reins of Geekdom's crown from Whedon,
sure.
which is good. And everything they've done so far, even though it's been, you know, Community and the Marvel movies, has been good, and everything they're attaching themselves seems promising, like doing Quantum and Woody.
Yeah.
Like, just like Lord and Miller, I suspect a lot of this stuff won't actually go forward with them. But I'm always glad to see them sort of branching out and developing.
But their
things.
Involvement is always a herald of good things.
Yeah. So, all right, that's it for the news. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week. We are talking comics for the week of Wednesday, October 4th, and. I know for Nick and Dave, this was sort of... You guys had a little trouble finding stuff this week, but this was a great week for me. Like, I loved almost everything I read,
yep.
Which means I had a difficulty finding picks in a different way, in that I had, like, a numerous picks. So, hedging against the possibility that I'm going to wind up cheater picking 100 things, I'm going to start with you guys. So, Nick, why don't you start off with what you got?
Okay, well, I've actually been looking forward to this one for a while, mainly because I like Garth Ennis. I love Goran Parlov's artwork. And Punisher, I don't know, growing up, he was one of my favorite characters. For obvious reasons of just mayhem.
There's also a lineage to this one because it ties into something else that Garth Ennis did.
But yeah, Garth Ennis has sort of done the quintessential Punisher during the Punisher Max series, which sort of took the character out of the Marvel Universe, mm-hmm. put it into just sort of our own real world.
Yeah. Right to the point of even having Frank be the proper age today, or often be drawn that way,
yeah.
as if he was had to have been in Vietnam, so he's like in his 60s looking
yeah.
guy.
Yeah.
And so this is sort of Ennis returning to that and kind of returning to the very first time Frank Castle was involved in the war. I mean, he's basically coming in on...
it's like his first command.
First command.
You've never said the name of this book.
Yes, this is Punisher the Platoon, number one.
So you guys both read and liked Bourne.
Yes.
I have never read it, and I feel like I need to after reading this.
Oh, you absolutely should.
Yeah. It's...
There's actually something really interesting that happens in Bourne, aside from just a tale of Punisher's past. It's a kind of a thought that,
it's kind of a nerving.
A conceptual thought about the Punisher that has definitely never been shown before.
Nope.
Right.
And that I'm like, I'm not even 100% sure I'm comfortable with.
Yeah.
But as a standalone story, I think it works amazingly.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Ennis...
Aside from being just... It's a disturbing... what's that movie? Full Metal Jacket kind of esque tale of Vietnam.
And that's sort of where we get in on this. It's about his first command in, Vietnam.
Yep. I thought it was interesting the way it starts, though. It starts in the present with some of the survivors of that, like, platoon.
Yeah, there's a framing device about a writer sort of wanting to do a... sequel, which I think is a callback to something that's happened in his run.
Yeah, it wasn't one I remembered, but it was clear that he had written a book about his tour with Frank Castle.
Yeah,
and felt like he maybe had another story to tell. Yeah, and was consulting with these guys.
I haven't read Bourne. Is the conceit maybe that he wrote Valley Forge based on the story we saw in Bourne?
I think that is the conceit. Yes,
that would make sense.
To more directly tie this into that.
Basically that, and then sort of the fallout of what Frank Castle became, like as the Punisher,
right?
And where this is sort of just kind of a war story in a lot of ways about his.
But he has a unique personality. There's something he does early on for sure to set himself.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there is, and it's interesting to see how he kind of gets to know his fellow soldiers mm-hmm. and kind of his ability to command. And
Garth Ennis once said that Punisher is a very simple character. You always know what he's going to do in a given situation.
Yeah.
I think this was probably a harder thing for him to figure out because. It's one thing if he's sort of in a platoon, like in Bourne, and like there's corruption within, and you kind of know how Punisher is going to deal with that, even in a early version of himself. Here is a Punisher that's decidedly less the guy we know,
yeah,
but not that decidedly less. But I feel like him when you see him interacting with a lot of troops, like having to literally lead them. He does kind of... I bet that required more mental work for Ennis, I think.
Well, yeah. And also, this is not the... I mean, I hate to say damage, but this is not the damaged Frank Castle that we do know. He's not... Right. He hasn't lost his family. He hasn't done any of that.
No. Right. Although he is still the guy who should be in Vietnam. It's funny, as I read this, that I knew it was Frank Castle, but as a younger Frank Castle, I wasn't seeing him the same way I see that, like, the Punisher when it fights him.
Yeah. But, I mean... It's just, it sort of immediately was intriguing, and Ennis just writes this character I think like no other writer has.
I also really like his ensemble. I like the platoon that he comes up with.
Yeah, and I like the older versions of the characters and sort of how they're kind of not really wanting to agree to
revisit or whatever.
Some of them don't want to revisit this stuff, and some of them do. Some of them feel like it's their kind of, they need to.
Well, I think they feel like they helped foist the Punisher on the world, and so they may feel guilty about that.
And then you get sort of just warfare.
Yeah.
And it's kind of feels very true to life, very Full Metal Jacket.
It's not like they're on the front lines shooting it out with them. In fact, you're seeing kind of how Punisher, that is, or that is, say, Frank Castle, handles tactics in his unorthodox way.
Yeah.
And in a way, to avoid that kind of grunt work combat like we're used to seeing in movies like Platoon, he does something kind of crazy, yeah. which is interesting.
Yeah.
There's definitely a larger story going on here with some villains at its core, but I don't know. It was a really good start to this. And Goran Parlov's artwork is amazing.
Yeah, the art is fantastic.
It's got that sort of realism to it, but it's beautiful.
Dave?
You know, it's funny. I know Nick is on an X-Men high this week, I think, yeah? kind of inspired by the, what's the new show?
The Gifted.
The Gifted.
We'll be talking about that next week.
Yeah, we didn't get a chance to watch it yet, yeah. so we're going to talk about it next week.
Oh, okay. But anyway, I ended up picking for my two picks, two X-books.
Yeah.
The first one is one that I had actually missed a few issues of, so I was kind of jumping in because this is a new story arc, and I had really liked what I'd read before. This is X-Men Gold, number 13. This is Mark Guggenheim's X-Men book, and it's the one that has the team led by Kitty Pryde,
yep.
and with the team made up of Storm, Nightcrawler, Colossus, Rachel Gray, and Old Man Logan.
It's also crossing over with X-Men Blue for a couple months.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, this is the start of the X-Men Gold, X-Men
there's
Blue
a lot
crossover.
There's a heavy presence from them in that. Oh, and I'm going to mention real quick out of the right out of the door the artist Mike Mayhew.
Oh, it's Mayhew? Who,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Who I thought was doing a really great job with it, and like I especially his version of Kitty. To me, looks like, yeah. I'm like, oh, that's 100% Kitty as I envision her.
Yeah.
You know, even with a few years kind of mentally mapped under from kind of the old days.
Also, I love his Cyclops in a batting helmet picture.
Yeah, it's a great shot. So, you know, you mentioned that there's an X-Men baseball game here.
Yeah.
You got you always got to appreciate the bits of downtime, and in this... It's actually less about the game and more about the conversations happening, people who are there watching.
Yeah.
And so, I'm going to give an example. Wolverine's talking to Old Man Logan is talking to Dokken.
No, not Dokken. That's Jimmy.
Oh.
That's from X-Men Blue.
Oh, he's the one from X-Men Blue. Okay, because I actually didn't quite know.
Yeah.
Is Dokken also back, though, somehow?
He's going to be an only Wolverine, but this is not Dokken.
This is the ultimate. He's basically Wolverine's
That makes
the
more
ultimate
sense.
Universe.
But anyway, I'm going to just read their dialogue. So they're kind of sitting there looking like an uncomfortable dad and son, you know, because you got, the kid?
Jimmy?
Jimmy. How old is he?
He's in his teens. He's same age as the other X-Men Blue.
So Old Man Logan is like, so Jeannie tells me you're my son. Seems like, from another universe, seems like, They both like kind of do the, there's some actually really great scenes in there, whether it's Kitty talking to Rachel, the two Wolverines. Or just seeing the X-Men play ball as drawn as awesomely as it is by Mayhew.
X-Men Gold has done this for now over a year, I guess, because it's bi-weekly, but over 12 issues.
Uh-huh.
It gives me things that I'd forgotten how much I wanted them.
Yeah.
Like, seeing the X-Men all get together to play baseball, that is so a thing from the 80s for me. That's like,
yep.
That is part of the team for me. And then they also have little moments like that Logan moment. There's a moment here where Kitty starts calling out orders and, like, dividing up the teams, and you see Jean Grey, who is theoretically the leader of the X-Men Blue, but is also younger, sort of nonplussed by this whole thing, because Kitty just kind of usurped her command.
Right, right, and you can tell this is going to be, that's a rising subplot.
Yeah.
The plot, do we want to say who the villain is? I feel like we probably could.
It's on the cover. It's on the title.
It's in the title. That was like the cover of this one has a different villain.
He's in the first page.
Right.
I think it's fair.
The storyline is called Mojo Worldwide.
Yep.
And it actually begins with a pretty funny bit of satire with Mojo talking to his major domo.
See that guy back too.
About changes to a script. They always have fun with Mojo when they're doing their. We're on the nose, but fun spoofs of like inside Hollywood stuff.
Yeah.
Here he's literally killed the writer.
By the way, Guggenheim is a Hollywood writer, so I'm sure that was very
He knows
satisfying.
Wherever he speaks. Mojo, of course, explains. He's like, everyone knows the script is just a suggestion.
By the way, Dave, speaking of meta stuff, which I know you and I sometimes find a little annoying.
Yeah.
Guggenheim levels it in just right here because. There's a meta thing where when things start hitting the fan,
yeah.
and Kitty looks up, she's like, every time we get the X-Men together for a baseball game, there ought to be a law or something like that. Yeah. I was like, that's a great call out.
Yep. You know, it's also a little bit, though, not unlike, you know, when we try and, with our small staff, try and sneak in at lunch sometimes, and we're like, oh my God, we suddenly, all the business picks up. I think probably every group has something they're like, oh, whenever we try and relax and do something, people, you know, kind of interfere, or I get a phone call from somebody with a crisis or whatever.
Right.
It's just that with the X-Men, it's that Mojo traps them in alternate timeline universe things or whatever is going on here.
I love the sort of, like, Legacy is the big, Marvel Legacy starts this week in earnest, so a lot of Marvel Legacy is going on, and I love the way they incorporate the Legacy theme into this.
Yeah. Yep. It's the alternate timelines and sort of famous storylines that you're going to know. I mean, the most famous of which is probably Days of Future Past.
Yeah.
But I think we can kind of at least say what the other ones are that are touched on.
Yeah.
There's also
Inferno,
mm-hmm. And is there a third one?
Asgard.
Oh, and Asgard, which was
that was so cool.
Frankly, they're picking all the ones from the 80s, all the ones from my youth, maybe early 90s.
And this is the thing. Apocalypse 80s. Is on the cover, so I guess we're probably going to see Age of Apocalypse at some point too.
Yep.
But it's funny. It's weird to me how Guggenheim, who's a writer I've never really loved,
yeah,
is somehow plugging into exactly what I want out of the X-Men. Like Asgard is, it's popular and all. Like, everybody likes Asgard, but I think, Dave, you and I have a particular fondness for it. And for them to hit something that we really like.
How old is Guggenheim?
He's got to be the same age as us.
I mean, is that the reason?
I think that's the reason.
Is he basically hitting on the stuff?
I've definitely felt right from the onset that he grew up probably roughly reading the same X-Men I did.
Yeah, and I'm kind of in the same ballpark.
And there is, you know, there's the risk of just being a nostalgia whore, but I feel like his stories have all this underlying structure that makes it, like, no different from, like, when I would be reading a kid, like, say, I'm going to say John Byrne's Fantastic Four when I was a kid, and he would do callbacks to Inhuman stuff from the Lee Kirby days, or Black Panther, or any of those other characters. And, you know, it wasn't there just for nostalgia. It was definitely there to, if you were around in those days, it's going to ring a little few extra bells.
Yeah.
But there was always the notion of taking that and propelling it into some new kind of story.
Yeah. If you were a kid, you didn't necessarily get what the callback was, but it was still cool.
Right.
And that's a
right. Cool, it gave you that sense of the broader universe, the kind of stories that have come before. And like you say, it fits the Legacy concept for the Legacy relaunch that begins sort of in earnest this week.
Well, and that's the difference, I think, between using nostalgia and meta humor clumsily, which too many people do, and using it well. It's not the tools are flawed, it's the people wielding them.
We had the tools, we had the talent. Ghostbusters call just out, saying, y'all. That's some actual nostalgia.
Just saying, if you're in the X-Men mood, like I think a lot of people will be this week, X-Men Gold is the comic you guys should try out.
Yeah,
it is
for
the
sure.
most sort of X-Men that we've had in years.
I love this book, and I continue to love this book.
Yeah.
My pick is a book that I'd sort of not been reading, and that is, this is part of Marvel Legacy, so it is Avengers number 672. I will not go off on a ranting on how stupid this renumbering is. I will try not to go off on a rant about how stupid this renumbering is. But
if people read between the lines, they might just be able to construct the rant from what's not there.
That's probably true. But what I will say about Avengers 672 is it is part one of a crossover between Champions and Avengers, in the same way that X-Men Gold, they seem to be trying to draft their audience between the two sister books in X-Men and Avengers. I think it's a good idea. And like X-Men, it is sort of a big world-shattering event that goes on. And in fact,
it is a literal world-shattering event.
And I read them back to back, and it bothered me a little bit because I was like, is everything, it's all the Legacy books going to be like big things
the
happening?
The sky is falling.
Like, and thankfully they're not. Like, the Iron Fist this week is a good Legacy book. But
I think you just happened to read two back to back that had not quite similar threats overall, but the delivery method of the threats was weirdly similar.
But so this is the Avengers and the Champions teaming up, and it's the Avengers team that Wade's been doing. And while I've been loving Champions, I haven't been reading Avengers because Wade was a little focused on Kang. Way too focused on Kang, who I like but don't need to see 30-some issues of.
Enough with the Kang.
So in this one, basically, there's a they're referring to something called Counter-Earth, which is an old Marvel thing created by the High Evolutionary. The notion is that it is exists on the opposite side of the sun from Earth.
Right.
That it's basically it's Earth, but it's on a different side of...
Old school concept. I remember this being around in some 70s comics my brother had, or maybe it even goes back earlier to like Lee Kirby stuff from the 60s. I can't quite remember.
Yeah.
But they do address a little bit of the... Why are we not spotted? Yeah, yeah. Like,
it
seems dodgy. Why isn't it throwing off all the other orbits?
I love that they did that. Basically, it starts with Amadeus Cho watching the news in the Champions headquarters in Austin, Texas.
Yep.
And
we should go by there sometime.
We should. And Spider-Man and the Wasp, the new Wasp, Nadia, who is a character I love, watching it at the Genius in Action Research Lab in New Jersey. And they're both watching this sort of this satellite thing that's going to go around and prove that basically the Counter-Earth isn't there. That Counter-Earth is some kind of alternate dimension thing, that people are wrong. And it's funny because Spider-Man, who has been there, is arguing with Nadia, and he's like, no, look, I've been there. It exists. I was not transported. And then basically it's sort of another meta nod to, yeah, Counter-Earth is goofy comic book science. You can hand wave it away with, you know, whatever comic science you want to, but it doesn't make sense. And so when they get to this satellite view, they see the void of space, and then this rock starts hauling toward Earth, comes out of this rift in space, which probably came from Counter-Earth.
Sort of like a big old Armageddon-like meteor thing.
And all the Avengers and the Champions have to get together and use all their powers and all their wits to stop this asteroid from creating an extinction-level event. It is a cool use of various powers. It introduces you to all the characters. It's got some nice character moments between Vision and his daughter, between the two Spider-Men, between Falcon and Miss Marvel as the two leaders of the team.
Yep. In classic superhero style, right in the middle of action, sometimes conflicts are being resolved or being forged.
Well, it's sort of like in what we were talking about in X-Men Gold, where Jean Grey is a little nonplussed by the Kitty taking over. Kamala is a little nonplussed by Sam taking over.
Yeah. And at the same time, as a hero worship, she kind of doesn't mind it.
True.
There's also, for me, a little callback because Hercules and Amadeus Cho wind up working together. Two of them...
I love.
Yeah, I mean, Amadeus Cho was created by Greg Pak. He was heavily featured in Hercules' run, which I'd forgotten about. But now the Hulk is... Amadeus shows the Hulk is more like Hercules, and so they interact on a different level. And I like that was a little callback. And I think that's what I think Legacy is going to do. It's not just, hey, here are comics for old men. Sorry about all the social justice we put in our comics.
Yeah.
I was worried that was what it was going to be. Right. That it was going to be like, they were going to sweep away Miss Marvel and Jane Foster Thor and all the stuff that I like in the name of trying to win back an audience that I'm not sure is there. And instead what they're trying to do is say, hey, you know what? Maybe you went a little too far about taking away some of your favorites and maybe not acknowledging sort of the long history of Marvel. So we're going to continue to do what we did, but we're also going to remind you that we remember these characters have had past interactions.
Right.
We remember that there's a history here, and we want to take advantage of it. And I think that's... I wish their marketing was making a better sale of it, because the actual product is doing a great job.
Right. Well, I did appreciate that, like, the X-Men Gold, for instance... is not like a seismic shift of by any means,
right?
In the storytelling style, it is a complete continuation of what had happened. You know, Old Man Logan didn't get wiped off the board. Kitty didn't change or anything like that.
Right.
But there is the sort of a sense of getting back to kind of like reminding you of the roots and how it like not just the roots, but also how the roots interact with the present.
Yeah, and it's, like you say, it's a slight tweak of what's been going on, maybe. It does feel different, but not in a way that's alienating to people who have been reading the comics, but in a way that might welcome back some people who haven't been around. So, if you haven't been reading Marvel for whatever reason, it's probably a good time to check back in, especially on these books that we're particularly recommending. Yeah. I'm going to save my backup pick, because I want to do my cheater picks all at the same time.
Uh-huh. You're going to mention the art in that, though?
The artist on Avengers is Jesus Saez, and he's fantastic.
What was he best known for? Was he working on Catwoman, or am I thinking of something else?
He might have done Catwoman. I know he did some Manhunter stuff.
That's right.
I think he might have co-created Kate Spencer.
Oh, yeah. I think you're
possibly.
Right.
Possibly. So,
yeah. I mean, it's just beautiful stuff.
It's really nice.
I think it's great.
By the way, I still want Kate Spencer back in DC Rebirth.
That'd be kind
of
cool.
There's no Manhunter that I know of over there. They need to bring her back. Put him in Birds of Prey
or
something.
They really should.
Anyway. Dave, why don't you do your backup pick?
All right. My backup pick is Iceman number 6. I don't think I've read a ton of the Iceman stuff or talked about it except whenever maybe it first came out.
Yeah.
But I think my initial reaction was, this comic is okay.
Yeah.
But I decided to read the last issue, the previous issue, just because it was the one where he came out to his parents, who are, I think, notoriously in comic have always been written as kind of the right-wing parents who don't... who like... embarrass their kid with awkward
they're
stuff.
They're bigoted about whatever. They're bigoted about mutants. His dad was bigoted against his Asian girlfriend.
Yeah.
They're not cool with the gay thing. Like, they're presented as the bigots.
They are super not cool with it in the previous issue, and they have to get through it. And they actually do come to an interesting, uncomfortable sort of detente by the end of it. But it felt pretty real in that issue, and I was impressed by it. There's a thing where Kitty is, like, there with him, and she was, I think, the one who kind of helped him to come out. And she's like, oh, she's trying to help, but she's kind of getting in the way all the fireworks with the parents.
Right.
And so he's like, Kitty, I think I actually need to do this solo. So he sends her away. And I was like, hey, there was just some good drama in that issue.
Yeah.
Well, this issue I decided to check out, not just because that one was a pretty good one, but also because it has the champions in it. Marvel's obscure old champions, the original ones from like the 70s that I read a few issues of when my brother had it.
So
old that the champions of Los Angeles. So old that Godzilla was still a license then, and they fought Godzilla, and Hercules knocked him off his feet, which was way cool.
Yeah.
Because they made a big thing of it. Herc got under his foot and flipped him.
So are the champions in this? Because most of those characters are occupied.
Yep. So they are all meeting up. I can't remember. Oh, it's they're there to actually mourn the loss of Black Widow from the events.
That makes sense. Okay, so Black Widow's not in this.
The events of what was the thing? Secret Empire that just wrapped.
Okay.
And they're actually we're gonna meet at their old headquarters in L.A. And they get there and they find out it's a gym. No, it's like a 24-hour fitness gym, and so they're all very put off by this. And so. The other members of the champions, for those who don't know, it's Johnny Blaze, the original Ghost Rider.
Yep. Who's also in another book this week.
Hercules.
Who's also in another book this week.
Angel.
Who's also in another book this
Archangel?
Week.
Archangel? I forget what he is now. And later on, I think maybe Darkstar appears.
Who is not in any other books.
The Darkstar doesn't get a lot of play. She's a Soviet superhero. She's a mutant.
I really like... Darkstar, and she is a mutant, just like her brother Vanguard, who's another cool character nobody ever uses.
Yep. Be interesting time right now. I wanna see how these characters are reacting to the rise of creepy fascism in Russia and all their machinations.
And actually,
because they were presented as originally, of course, as patriots, but usually with a conscience. They weren't just like they were the Marvel of time. Was trying to show our Cold War enemies as having a little nuance to them.
Right, even if they were clearly wrong because they were evil comics.
Right. Wise up, but you're an honorable guy.
Yes, that's exactly why. Presented in the 80s and the 70s.
So this is kind of what I would call a downtime issue. There is the characters sitting around drinking and talking, and then something interesting happens where there is a subplot that is a sort of action-y subplot, but it's definitely takes backseat. But essentially, he runs into a possible love interest. He goes on a date.
Okay.
Which I guess, even though he's been out of the closet for, like, what, a year?
Yeah, but you know what? A younger guy, right?
Well, this is not the younger Iceman. This is the...
What, really?
I think, right? Isn't this the... This is older Iceman... because he's got his parents to deal with.
Oh, yeah, so he is actually dealing with...
Right. His parents are like, oh, what about all those girls you dated, Bobby? Bobby, right? Yeah.
Bobby.
And he's like, did you ever wonder why I didn't stick with them,
Yeah.
And he, basically, their retcon, because it wasn't retcon, was that it was an explanation that sort of worked for a guy who was just generally written with a string of girlfriends that generally didn't stick.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, in this one, there's some pretty strong writing here from writer Cena Grace.
Oh, I like Cena Grace.
No idea who that is.
I believe Cena Grace has been an editor and written some of their stuff as well.
Okay. Anyway, interesting flirtations that come about with Iceman and another guy. Iceman is like, I'm new to having come out of the closet, and this guy is kind of... tongue-in-cheekily, but warmly kind of guiding him through that a little bit. And let me see if I can find the line. I really should have looked this up ahead of time. Randy, you just edit this out.
We don't edit.
They go to a club, and the champions kind of like, they go out with him kind of to support him. So that's like the champions at the club and Iceman at the club. And he's out dancing with his possible boyfriend, and Iceman is like, or Bobby is like, this is my first time dancing with a guy. I'm doing pretty good, right? And the guy's like, yes, you're a certified gay now. And he's like, do I get a card? So there is some, you know, classic kind of good quippy dialogue, and but it's also kind of sweet.
Dave,
yeah.
I have a question about the club.
Yeah.
And I know that there are no sounds in comics, but some of those sound effects.
Yeah.
Are there bumping booty beats?
Damn well looks like it.
Okay, good. I need to know.
Anyway, so downtime character-centric issue that also does set up essentially a action-y reunion with the champions. But this one is all about the character stuff. I don't have any particular love of Iceman. I just think the writing is good. And I think the last two issues have been pretty particularly strong. It's also the first part of a story, you know, so I think anybody could get in on this.
You've intrigued me to go back after reading this in the last couple. I always had a fondness for the champions as well, even though I've never read any of the original stuff.
Yeah.
I like the weird team.
Yeah, and I actually thought, I like how they handled it here, where it was kind of like, oh, that was kind of a strange time. We hung out in the past. It's kind of, it's a little bit, it was a little goofy, but they're still friends, and they still want to remember, you know, Black Widow and all that. They still have sort of nostalgia for their time. In other words, they sometimes, with that kind of stuff, it's treated as like a joke.
Yeah.
They don't treat it as a joke.
Okay.
It's kind of fond memories and a little bit of humor.
Do they happen to make reference to the new champions at all? Like, that the kids took their name?
Yep.
Nice.
Yep. I think one of them is like,
I imagine it was Hercules.
I think somebody said something kind of disparaging, like so who was angsting a lot, probably in those old Champions comics.
Yeah.
He's like the Champions have never brought anything but misery. And I think at some point he says something like, you know, except for the new team, they're pretty good guys.
Yeah.
You know, they seem to have it together.
Cool.
So yeah, there was an acknowledgement at the very least.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to read this. That sounds really good. You've sold me on Iceman, which I thought was an impossible
job. Nick,
My backup pick is another Marvel Legacy book. This is the Spirits of Vengeance Part 1.
Yep.
Which again, I have a lot of fondness for the Spirits of Vengeance name and Ghost Rider in general.
Yeah. Is it a different team from the 90s?
It is. In the 90s, it was Danny Ketch Ghost Rider and Johnny Blaze with his magic shotgun.
And Morbius and Hannibal King.
No, they were Night Stalkers.
Oh, they were the Night... But they were part of it. They were involved in
Spirits
there.
Of Vengeance, well, Spirits of Vengeance was the book.
Yeah, Spirits of Vengeance.
But there was also the Midnight Suns.
Midnight Suns, yes. But Spirits of Vengeance, this one is Johnny Blaze, Damon Hellstrom, Blade, and Satana.
Yeah.
Which... If you're going to get kind of
the dark supernatural characters
of the Marvel Universe,
it's a good team.
Yeah,
it's not unlike, say, Doctor Strange's Secret Defenders in their 90s book.
Yeah.
I feel like Blade is the kind of guy who's probably at any moment thinking he could kill all of them, though.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he probably is thinking
The recruiting scene for Blade is one of my favorites in the
book. Yeah, it's great. But it sort of opens up with an event happening in a bar that Johnny Blaze is basically taking up residence on a stool and getting drunk.
Yeah.
And leads him to Damon Hellstrom. And from there, you kind of get at this tour of the supernatural universe that Marvel is kind of creating that is kind of not Doctor Strange.
Yeah. No, this is a different thing. Also, I really like the reinvention of Johnny Blaze as sort of the drunken has seen it all and just doesn't want to be bothered guy.
Yeah, he's just tired of it all.
Yeah,
yeah. I have always liked Johnny Blaze, and that, although that's not quite how he used to be, feels like a good evolution and a good place for him to be.
I feel like Johnny Blaze and Logan, and Old Man Logan, should have a drink off.
I agree.
Yeah.
But I also like Victor Gishler, who's the writer here. I like his portrayal of Damon Hellstrom as kind of this more Jason Blood kind of character.
Or Constantine
kind of character.
He has been drifting in that direction for a good while
now.
I just remember him.
In fact, I think Ellis did write him.
Ellis made him sort of actively evil, though.
That's right.
This is more of a fixer, a magic fixer type.
I just remember Damon Hellstrom as sort of the shirtless trident.
Yeah. He had a fiery trident and a shirtlessness.
Yes.
So with like a pentagram tattoo or something.
Transitioning him to more of this dapper looking kind of guy is a good transition. I think it makes sense.
They need more sexy demonologists.
Sure.
I'm or whatever it is that. He is.
And of course, like Randy said,
he's a demon.
The introduction
he is the son of Satan. Yeah.
The introduction of Blade is fantastic, and Blade is one of those characters that I've always liked, and has always felt like he shows up in kind of the oddest places in Marvel books. But it's
fascinating that, especially since his popularity from the movie, he's become a sort of recurring NPC. You know, like he is like. a lot more than he used to be. It used to be he'd show up in Doctor Strange every once in a while, and maybe if somebody thought to use him, some other comic, and that was it.
Did he first show up in Tomb of Dracula? Is that right?
Yeah, he was created by, like, Marv Wolfman and Gene Colan back in the day.
By the way, two really cool trades hit this week of Tomb of Dracula and Werewolf by Night.
Yeah.
So,
in those days, he was, you know, very clearly kind of like the Vampire Hunter version of Shaft.
Yeah.
And he definitely is, like, been kind of remodeled a bit in the Wesley Snipes vein.
He's been sniped.
Yes.
But that was obviously, those were some kick-ass movies, and so
they've still never managed to make an ongoing series work with him. I think he is better, as you say, as like a guest star.
Yeah, and I'm fine with that. Like, I think not everybody needs to have one. I like the Vision a lot, but for the most part, I don't want a Vision book.
Although some people thought that Vision book was the best comic of 2016 or 2015 or whatever.
I mean, it was really
good. What issue is it on now?
Limited series. but for to use an example, I love me some D-Man. I don't really want a D-Man solo book.
Yep.
I mean, I'd read it, but no one else would.
Technically, you got D-Man in an ensemble for 2 years.
Yeah. No, I'm good with that. There wasn't enough D-Man in there, but...
So, is this a putting the band together kind of issue?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the entire team. We haven't yet to see Satana, but you get a lot of bang for your buck here. And
I do always like those kind of stories.
Can we talk about a general trend this week that I liked was that people have in a lot of ways forgotten how to write a first issue. Like, they'll always write the first part of a... And I feel like there were a lot of good first issues this week where, they did... Yeah. I think Marvel may have even had an editorial thing where they said, look, make sure the new people come into this book... Know who your characters are, know what their powers are, that kind of thing. Because I felt like that came across in all the books I read in a way that it doesn't always.
Right. Maybe a little bit more, Jim Shooter, honestly.
Which Marvel could use a heavy dose of.
Yeah. I think it's not... I bet it's an easy trap to fall into of assuming everybody is a hardcore reader and writing for them.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can get some deep stories out of that, but it can be utterly impenetrable if you have not been keeping up with the book for a while. Yeah. So it's nice to see them, kind of breaking that mold.
They also have that little three-page thing at the end that I think is... they're not all written by Robbie Thompson, but a lot of them are, and they've got different artists on them, and it's like a... Oh, they may all be written by Robbie Thompson. I see this one is too. But it's like a recap, the three-page recap of the characters and the concept of the book.
Yeah, it looks like they are all written by Robbie Thompson.
It's a little bit like when DC did those one- or two-page strips that were the character recaps. Yeah. Here's what the story of Nightwing is, or here's whatever.
And Marvel did those little fold-out covers in the 90s with them, and they always go away, but I always like them. I like that sort of introductory for new people.
Yeah. Randy, is it
all right,
is it time?
I wasn't sure if Nick had said everything you wanted to say.
No, I did. I would recommend this one.
I also really liked it.
Yeah.
Okay, my backup pick is a smaller book called Slots Number 1. It's from Image and Skybound. It is written and drawn by Dan Panosian, who is a guy, you probably don't know his name. He's done a lot of inking. He's done a few things. But his craft has gotten so good.
He's a badass artist.
And this reminds me of the late, great Darwin Cook. It is a story of like a hustler and a con man who basically used to run around in Vegas, has a lot of enemies everywhere. We see him running this sort of low level scam on a waitress at a diner, and then driving out to the country to pull up a gun where I think he's pretty clearly about to kill himself. He's done all he could do, and he gets a call from an old friend in Vegas to call in a favor. So he drives back into a beautifully rendered version of Vegas and goes to meet this friend who runs a burlesque club who's having problems with her talent, who also happens to be her daughter. And this also puts him up against a casino owner who's his old friend. He runs into an old friend who used to be a boxing promoter. Turns out this guy is an ex-boxer who got kind of washed up. And now he's going to sort of run some kind of scheme to try and help out his friend, and also maybe reconcile with his estranged son.
Oh, right.
And it's nothing you haven't seen before, but it's done really well, and it happens to be in sort of the small-town crime vibe of, like, Elmore Leonard and Richard Stark and the kind of stuff that is totally in my wheelhouse. I wasn't sure. I'm never sure how artists are going to do as writers, and I thought this was really, really well done. The dialogue is fun. The characters are really well done, and of course the art is stunning. I would definitely recommend this to people. This guy has a little bit of that like Danny Ocean from Ocean's 11 in him.
Yeah.
Like this is really like the greatest hits of what Randy likes about crime. So I may be a little biased.
Yeah.
But if you also like that kind of stuff, if you like Parker novels, if you like Ocean's 11, if you like con man stories, Joe Lansdale stuff, you know, his Happy
Leonard. If you like Snarky Losers.
Snarky Losers. I hope you like Snarky Losers. That's my brand. give that a shot. It's really good. Stuff that didn't quite make my cut because of how much good stuff was this week, but could easily have been a pick. Harley and Ivy Meet Betty and Veronica is every bit as fun as you'd like. It's Dini and Mark Andreyko writing it. It's the modern-day Riverdale characters. The reason why Harley and Ivy come to town is that Veronica Large's father is going to pave over Sweetwater Swamp and turn it into a mall and a college, a for-profit university. So it's like all the trifecta of bad things he can do, like environmental, taking advantage of people, and also building like a rampant consumerism, which Poison Ivy wants no part of. So she and Harley are going to go to town and try to do some damage. And at the same time, there is a gala going on where people have to wear costumes. And Betty and Veronica come to a point where they wind up sort of having to do a theme costume together, even though they don't like each other. And the theme costumes they have a very limited selection. And you can probably guess from the title of the book what costumes they wind up in. It was a really fun, and I'm looking forward to seeing where they go with it.
Did we mention that it is co-written by Harley creator Paul Dini?
Yes, it is. Okay. But I didn't say his name, Paul. Paul Dini.
You got to say it that
Dini
way.
Dini and Draco. There is a new Boom book called Eugenic that is set in 2035 AD, and it is about a sort of a plague that was going across mankind. This genius geneticist who created a vaccine that allowed for live births again, and then I don't want to give too much away, but the live births seem to be sort of weird mutants. And when he unveils why he did this, it's a crazy, interesting sci-fi premise. And then the end of it promises that the next issue is going to start 200 years later, and we're going to see how this all worked out. It's a fantastic setup for a
book. That's some craziness.
This is James Tinian and I believe Eric Donovan, who did, I think they did The Woods for Boom, which is another sort of high concept sci-fi. This really hooked me, and I'm very anxious to see where it goes next. Voltron Legendary Defender gets a new number one. This is the second volume. It's based on the series. Basically, all you need to know is that it's written by one of the guys who writes for the animated series. It has the personalities of the characters in here. There were several laugh-out-loud moments for me. Great action. And it introduces elements into the show that we haven't seen because it's sort of a side plot. If you love Voltron and want more, I know usually it's hard to get tie-ins that really do things well. This really feels like a part of the book in the same way sort of the Avatar comics feel like they belong.
The previous series I noticed was like kind of went under a lot of people's radar, and it was because it was also a smaller release.
Yeah.
But the people who did pick it up were really enjoying it, and then noticed by the end it had really gained some momentum. So I have a feeling that this new miniseries could take off nicely.
I hope so. I really liked the last one. I bought it in trade. I'm very happy with it. Batman White Knight is an Elseworlds, though it's not tagged as such, because they don't use the Elseworlds brand anymore, which is dumb. But Sean Murphy writes and draws a story of basically Batman going too far, the Joker essentially curing himself, and what happens next. It's a pitch I wasn't sure about, but the presentation of it is not bad, and I'm curious to see where he goes with it. The Archies number one is the story of the Archie rock band, Betty, Veronica, Jughead, and Archie, and their band, and whether they're going to break up or go on tour. It's a fun first issue.
I think you should break up.
I have some bad news for
not you. To be a downer, but
I have some bad news for you.
I feel like they're not coming together as a band.
Yeah. they do not go that way.
No!
I don't want to spoil anything. But
actually, I think a good story could be told about the band having broken out. But yeah, probably not how you want to kick off the band comic.
But if you were going to do that, you would call it the Archies Breakup. That's what you'd call the series.
Yep. And actually, I would do it. I do it at issue 12.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, the Archies break up? ?
Yeah, and then the cover will be torn apart. And, Archie would be tearing the cover and saying, no more.
Yep, and there would be an alternate cover that would be the Spider-Man gives up being Spider-Man, where it's the costume's in a trash can, except it'd be Jughead's like little crown and like his like a leather jacket or something like that.
Yeah.
Let me tell you what the other alternate covers would be.
Keep going.
That's it. That's all I got.
Okay. All New Guardians of the Galaxy number 11. I haven't been reading this book, but I checked back in because I saw Richard Rider Nova and Darkhawk on the cover, and I was not disappointed. This is the story of Richie's brother... what's his name? Something Roberts. Robbie. His brother Robbie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was a Nova. He disappeared during the end of the Abnett Landing stuff. And this goes into what happened to him. Ties into the Darkhawks, which are now like a Shi'ar special commando force.
Yeah. That was an Abnett thing.
It's interesting. I'd forgotten about it. But it's a really good issue and makes me want to go back and check in on what's going on in Guardians of the Galaxy. This has a feel more like the Abnett Landing stuff than I expected. So I always felt that Bendis was not paying homage to the Abnett Landing stuff in the right way. And I know it shocks you guys to hear me criticize Bendis in any way, since I'm his biggest fan after Spider-Man's last
book. But it seems like Jerry Dugan kind of gets that.
But Dugan's doing some good stuff with it, so I want to check back in on that book, and it's kind of a jumping on point. Hawkeye number 11, I love Hawkeye. This is another great Hawkeye book.
And you love issue 11s.
I like Kate Bishop as much as I do like issue 11s, because I also liked Injustice 2 number 11 this week, which continues to have Tom Taylor writing the best version of Harley Quinn I've ever seen. He's also sort of introducing the Young Justice team of this Injustice world. So we see Nat, the niece of Steel, and what happened to Steel in Metropolis, which you might remember got nuked in the Injustice world.
Yeah, yeah.
And the new Calderon, the Aqualad. And then we see Blue Beetle, so I think they may be building toward forming a Young Justice team. There's also some great stuff with Batman and Poison Ivy and Harley Quinn, and Damian and Bruce Wayne. This is the DC universe I want, and continues to be that, and it's really, really good. Elseworld number 3 continues the story of Amelia Earhart and what's the bank robber's name? DB Cooper.
Yep.
In a crazy fantasy world. It's another great issue. They find a submarine. I won't say any more than that. And then I want to mention two trades. Doctor Strange Epic Collection Afterlife, which is some crazy number volume. It's like number 13. And the reason I mention it is it features a run by Warren Ellis, where he did sort of a different take on Doctor Strange, yep, which I really liked. There's also some stuff by J.M. DeMatteis, a couple 90s writers, Pat Quinn and Evan Skolnick. A different version of Doctor Strange that had a different costume and some different powers. But
a pretty clear concept of what they wanted to do, I think. Yeah, I haven't read it, but if I know a little bit about Warren Ellis, I know that he usually has a pretty coherent vision.
Yeah. And sort of turning him into sort of a dark magician was a cool thing.
Yep.
Then there's this Marvel Vehicles Owner's Workshop Manual, which is basically all the vehicles from helicarriers, including the Department H helicarrier, the Monster Hunting helicarrier, to the Shield Flying Car, to the Alpha Flight Omnijet.
It's like Ghost Rider's Hellcycle.
Ghost Rider's Hellcycle.
At the risk of potentially deflating this, does it have the X-Men's Blackbird in there?
It does.
Okay, cool. I wasn't sure if they might be like still in a little bit of a... We're not sure if we want to pitch the X-Men stuff too much.
In fact, I believe there's basically a section, because there's the X-Copter.
Yep.
Which is a thing from... I don't know, is that X-Men Blue? I don't even know what that is.
I've never heard of such a thing.
Oh, it looks like it's new X-Men. Maybe.
I think they should call it the X-Men Whirlybird, but
there's
me.
The Dove and the Stratojet and the original Blackbird, which is listed as having five generations.
The Stratojet's not that one that was that rockety-looking thing that they flew around in Neil Adams' era?
Yeah.
Cool. I'll have to flip through this.
Dave, in fact, there are 8 pages on the Blackbird.
Nice.
With art. Oh, 10 pages with art from the various comics, with designy type stuff showing what the jets look like. This is like everything I want in the Marvel Universe.
It's pretty legit.
I may have to wind up picking this up, actually. It's really cool looking. And when I was a kid or a teenager, I loved these kind of books.
Yeah.
This
people
is
who fondly remember Elliot R. Brown's drawings from the old Marvel Universe will feel very at home here.
As will hopefully the kids who will finally remember these drawings.
Yes.
Because who have no idea what the nostalgia value of it is.
Yeah, basically anybody who's going to enjoy a cool technical drawing of a cutaway section and stuff like that of vehicles and finding out about their cool details.
Yeah, it's super cool. Good for adults and also for kids.
Yes.
Dave, what else you got?
I think these are some books that I haven't necessarily gotten around to, so Nick and Randy, if you have anything to contribute, just mention it. Tick has a new series written by Cullen Bunn.
Oh, that dude's writing everything.
He really is. If you're like, where has the Tick been in my life other than on my TV? I need him back in comics again.
It looks like on the cover he is fighting ninjas and scary clowns.
Yep. The threats of our time.
Yep.
There's a new Batman Shadow crossover, this one called Shadow Batman.
Mm.
I don't know exactly what the deal they worked out with, but basically it seems like DC did one crossover series and Dynamite did the other one.
And they co-published.
And this one is interesting. It's got, it was unusual and I couldn't quite tell where it was going with some of it because it's got like Professor Pig in it, a weird clash between Batman and Damian. as its backdrop.
I believe, here's the weird thing, I believe the last one was sort of the DC one, because it was written by Snyder, right?
Yeah, it was.
And I think they were sort of clearly like enjoying using the Shadows toys.
Yeah.
And this one seems to be the Shadow guys enjoying using the Batman toys. Who creates this?
Let's see, Steve Orlando.
Okay,
he was writing.
He's a DC
guy
too.
Justice League.
No, he's writing Green Arrow.
Green Arrow.
Yeah.
Okay,
he was writing Green Arrow. He's not now. Benjamin Percy is writing.
Right.
Yeah, there is some Shadow stuff in here, but I would say it is more prominently a first issue of a Batman one. Although there's a cool sequence where Shadow goes into stealths into the prison where Professor Pig is being held to kind of interrogate him with his crazy Shadow kind of see in the hearts of men kind of thing.
Yep.
And, it's a cool sequence that speaks to what the Shadow doesn't know.
Oh.
That's actually all I've got. Nick, I see you've got a few more things on the list.
Yeah, just a few more things to add. Iron Fist number 73. Also, Iron Fist number whatever.
Yeah.
but let's not get into numbering. This is a cool issue that has Danny Rand teaming up with Sabretooth.
This also, good use of legacy because Sabretooth came from the Iron Fist comics.
Yeah, he did.
I had not been reading the Iron Fist book, even though you told me I should be.
Yes, you should have.
And clearly I need to, because I should really enjoy this.
Yeah. It's good. It takes up sort of where the last arc left off. Shalal's living in Danny Rand's apartment, which is really weird. But it's kind of cool.
That's kind of funny.
It is cool.
Living in Danny Rand's apartment?
The dragon.
Okay, fair enough.
Who I thought he had killed.
No, you don't kill. You just plunge your hand into and take its heart.
Dragons don't need hearts?
They have probably multiples.
Okay,
I don't.
Fair enough.
Star Wars number 37, which starts up a new story arc featuring the elite stormtrooper team that I think has been...
Scar Squadron.
Yeah, Scar Squadron.
Oh, I like those guys.
And opens up with the leader of Scar Squadron who is kind of screwed up at the mercy of Darth Vader and kind of goes from there.
This is still Jason Aaron, right?
This is still Jason Aaron and Salvador La Roca.
Maybe his last story.
It might be.
These do seem to be his characters, the Scar Squadron.
And it's a really, really cool kind of badass story. Old Man Logan 29, which is sort of the penultimate issue of the Redneck Hulks versus Old Man Logan and Hawkeye.
Yep.
Batman 32 finishes out the War of Jokes and Riddles and gives readers the answer to the question of Bruce had for Selina Kyle and Will You Marry Me?
Mm-hmm.
Astonishing X-Men number 4, which continues the Shadow King story versus various members of the X-Men on the
Astral Plane.
I was like,
this also felt like a little interlude issue to some extent, because it's about the relationship between Mystique and Phantom X, and
yep.
the relationship between Rogue and Gambit.
Yep.
And I'm not hugely invested in either one of those, but I liked what they did here.
Yeah, I liked the Phantom X and Mystique stuff. This also has some pretty cool rendition of Bishop's powers.
Yeah, that was cool.
And Solak gets to be kind of a badass.
Yeah.
Which I'm always a fan of.
X-Men Gold is still my favorite X-Men book, but Astonishing is a solid second place.
And this one has really nice art by Carlos Pacheco.
Yeah, it does.
Green Arrow number 32, which is the finale to the DC Dark Knight's metal tie-in, the Gotham Resistance storyline. Okay. This is a solid ending to that. Darth Vader number 6, which sees Darth Vader go up against the Grand Inquisitor from Rebels.
Oh, nice.
Which is kind of a fun callback.
Yeah, yeah.
And then my last one is Dark Knight's metal tie-in Batman the Dawnbreaker, which is the Green Lantern version of the evil Batman of the Dark Multiverse. It is particularly violent, as I think all of these are sort of the darkest story that these writers could come up with.
Yeah.
So one can imagine a story where a young Bruce Wayne, after the murder of his parents, goes a little evil when given a Green Lantern ring.
You know, it's interesting. That Batman medal, the Dark Knight's medal that has the picture of all the different evil dark Batman multiverse things.
Yeah.
That may be the most eye-catching display we've ever had. Like, everybody sees it and everybody asks about it.
Yep. And it's pretty cool looking.
Yeah, everybody loves Dark Batman for the multiverse.
This one is written by Sam Humphries, who I'm coming around on being a fan of his writing, and artwork by Green Lantern person Ethan Van Shiver.
I am going to quick call back, Randy, that that Marvel vehicle owner's workshop manual. Now that I've looked through it, I you may have mentioned this, but I just saw the Runaways Leapfrog in there.
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah, it's got the Leapfrog, and for you Deadpool fans out there, I guess he's got a ship called the Deadpool Corps. Well, it's for the Corps, the B Arthur.
Yes,
the B Arthur is in there. Deadpool wrote the
write-up. Damn it, Deadpool.
I also saw, like, Hawkeye Sky Cycle.
It's got Thanos' Sanctuary class starship.
I can't believe the Leapfrog is there. That's so cool.
Yeah, there is some deep cuts in there. I mean, I saw the Alpha Flight's jet in there. The Spider-Mobile is in there.
Punisher Battle Van is in there.
Oh, man, Scuttlebutt. Blade Ray Bill's ship is in there. So, anyway, yes, just a little bonus endorsement of that.
That's really good.
For the deep cuts.
Yeah. All right, that's it for Comics of the Week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about some TV and a board game. All right, the fall season is upon us, and Nick is watching more shows than I am. Yes. But we both watched a couple shows this week.
Yeah.
We want to talk about one new comedy, one returning comedy I don't think we've mentioned on the podcast before. Right. So the new comedy is called Ghosted. It's on Fox. Stars Adam Scott and Craig Robinson.
Yep.
And it is basically a sort of a Men in Black style setup, basically.
Men in Black meets Ghostbusters meets
Midnight Run.
Midnight Run, yeah.
Well, what are these particular people covering up if it's Men in Black?
So it's everything. It's everything supernatural and alien. Sort of think of like Warehouse 13 or The Middleman or one of those. It's like everything supernatural and everything alien.
What do they call it? It's the, what is their organization called? It's
oh man, I'm blanking on it. And it's one of these things, they work it into other things.
Yeah,
like when
they did.
Their cover is worked into it. It's called The Company or something like that.
It's something very generic sounding. Yeah.
It reminds me just in a roundabout way of Night Vale, where it's like all sort of conspiracies and strangeness are true.
So basically what happens in the opening credits the opening sequence is that Adam Scott is this former astrophysicist whose wife was kidnapped by aliens, and nobody believes him, and so he basically lost everything and became worked at like a Walden Books.
Yep.
Or a Borders, or whatever it is that's still in business.
As you say, yeah, people don't know what the hell Walden Books is.
The Bureau Underground.
The Bureau Underground is what it's called.
Okay.
So he is tranked and dragged into this thing, and then the other guy, Craig Robinson, plays a guy who was like LA's best detective, like LAPD best detective, and then something went wrong. I don't remember exactly what. Did he lose his... He couldn't find someone.
No, he caused the death of his partner.
Caused the death of his partner, that's right. Yeah. And he was like a missing persons detective, and he basically winds up like busted down a mall security guard.
Uh-huh.
And so they both have sort of fallen from grace, but they're both these guys who are clearly skilled, and they get recruited in this organization for their... There's a guy who goes missing in the early part who basically asks for them by name.
Yeah, he's like the best... agent for the Bureau Underground,
and so there's these two rookies get recruited. They have very different personalities. You could definitely say that that Adam Scott is more like the Duke, and Craig Robinson is more like Robert De Niro's character.
Uh-huh.
And they definitely they noted that they wanted this to be sort of Midnight Run. In fact, there's an homage in one of the exchanges that is sort of a why aren't you popular with the LAPD
kind of
thing. That was all you needed for me. Honestly, Midnight Run's one of my favorite movies, and to do a callback in any way won me over. But I really like this setup, and I really like the chemistry between Craig Robinson and Adam Scott. I do feel like Craig Robinson, unfortunately, is a guy who, whenever he sort of comes to a lead as opposed to an ensemble piece, he's not as strong.
Right.
I think that's true here, too.
I agree. I mean, I'm a big fan of Adam Scott, so I tend to watch what he's in. I think for me it wasn't the strongest pilot in the land.
It's not the strongest pilot.
But I the bare bones are there, and I like the back and forth between the two characters, so I'm definitely in for the next couple of episodes to sort of see it kind of become its own thing.
Well, and I just finished watching The Middleman, which... Did you watch The Middleman?
I didn't watch all of it. I watched a lot of it.
Yeah.
And I loved it.
And so I feel like this is kind of like The Middleman in that people didn't really know what it was, and it was on ABC Family, and it never really got a chance. This one's on Fox. It's got a little bit more of a chance, although still they're pretty cancel-happy.
They are.
But this is one of those shows that I can basically see being a brilliant but canceled. We're all going to look back and be like, why didn't people watch this? And I hope that doesn't happen, because I think the potential is there for this to be really good.
Well, I think the notion of like a sitcom Men in Black serialized, it works. So I think it definitely has the chance.
Comedy pilots are hard.
They are.
And the fact that this was solid but unspectacular is still promising to me with that cast and this premise. So I recommend people look at it. I'm looking forward to the second episode to see what it's going to look like now they've sort of put them all together.
What's the name of the show?
Ghosted.
Ghosted, right.
Then I want to talk about one that, coming back to the second season, called Great News.
Yeah.
That's about a local TV station in New York?
Yes, it's. I believe it's New York.
Yeah, it might be New Jersey, but I think it's New York.
I think, it is New York.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's basically, it's the lead character is Brigha Heelan, who is this stunning blonde woman you may have seen in, I don't know, she was in Netflix's Love. She was in a USA show nobody saw called Ground Floor. She, I think, had a guest spot in one of the Pitch Perfect movies or something. She's been around in things. But she's really funny and really has great sort of physical comedy chops.
Yep.
And her mom, her sort of overprotective mom, is played by Andrea Martin, the sort of SCTV legend.
Yeah.
And I can remember who the anchor is. It's another sort of Joe Leisure type dude. I can remember what his name is.
He's the guy from Pitch Perfect.
Pitch Perfect.
He's the
right.
announcer.
Yeah. And he's great. Basically, this is a small town or a New York small TV station doing their news. And she becomes a field reporter. Her mom becomes an intern. And there's all kinds of stuff. It's basically an ensemble cast of these weird people putting together a news story. Nicole Richie? Isn't it?
Yeah, Nicole it's Richie? Nicole Richie.
Nicole Richie plays the sort of younger, somewhat dim-witted co-anchor to the older, more established news anchor.
I think Ron Burgundy style.
Ron Burgundy style, yeah. An old white man who is not up with the times, but drinks in his fame.
And I know you're probably eye-rolling because Nicole Richie, you really don't expect
anything.
She's
really good in this.
She's really funny.
She's thrown
Nicole
herself
Richie
into the
Richie is...
From Paris Hilton and Nicole.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah. I was just double-checking.
Yeah,
She's playing herself as a news anchor. In
right, but there is enough knowledge or wit about her to not just do that clumsily or something like
that. Enough self-awareness that I think of her persona, I think.
But it feels very kind of 30 Rockian in a lot of aspects.
It's a wacky local news thing.
Yeah, it's a wacky local news.
And
they're not
also
the greatest. They're in like fourth or fifth place.
Right, and they've got some... Horatio Sands plays one of the... Yep. The anchors. I think one of the guys who developed the show is one of the guys who did 30 Rock and Kimmy Schmidt and all that kind of thing. Robert Carlock, maybe?
I think so.
It may be somebody else. Anyway, as a result, they've brought Tina Fey on as their new boss in season 2.
Yes.
And she plays...
The female version of Alec Baldwin?
The female version. What's her name, though? It's like something St. Clair.
Yes.
She's like a female Trump type. She's written all these female empowerment books.
She doesn't sleep.
She doesn't sleep. She's like the perfect businesswoman.
Always doing Kegels.
And Brigha Heelan wants to basically be wants her to mentor her. And she's great and clearly enjoying the scenery chewing role.
Yeah.
Andrea Martin's sort of overprotective mom bit and sort of clueless old person... That sort of won me over. Like this show, I didn't love it first, but by the time I got to the end of it last season, I was all in. And the second season comes in really strong. I don't think you have to watch the first season.
No, you don't. But it's one of those ones that I would recommend going back. It's
for sure.
It's definitely worth it.
But if you're a Tina Fey fan, check this out. It was really funny.
Yes.
Finally, I want to mention a board game that I played that came in for us a little while back. It's called Sagrada, Sagrada, which probably is some kind of Italian word for stained glass windows. Because this is a game, it's a dice-building game of building stained glass windows.
Yep.
So every player has a little stained glass window thing that you put an insert in, and you have either colors or numbers, and you have to build a four-column-by-five-row window. And it's kind of like the game Fuse. Like, you roll dice, and then you pick a die, and then you pass it on to the next person. It's sort of a dice drafting game.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no time limit, unlike Fuse, so it's not quite as stressful.
That's good. I like less stressful.
But the thing is, you can't put the same color next to each other, and you can't put the same number next to each other.
Okay.
So you have to sort of think ahead as you're going it, and everybody may take stuff that you then wanted. And the goal is to basically finish your... And then you put different goals down. Like, the goals we had were... for every row you had that had four different colors in it, you got points.
Right.
For every pair of one and two you had on your board, you got points. And for every five sets of colors you had, you got points.
Okay.
So you have that, and then everybody else has a separate card that is your number, your color. So I had red. So basically, at the end of the game, however many red dice I had, I added the number on the face, and I got those many bonus points. And there's little tools you can do to, like, change the numbers on the dice or move some dice around, that kind of thing. You get a certain amount of points to do that kind of stuff. It's a pretty simple but deceptively hard game because I thought I had it, and then I hosed myself at least three times. Like, by putting down a number in the wrong place or by not realizing that the diagonals didn't matter and thinking, oh, I can't put it down here. And they'd be like, no, you can put that down there. It's not, it's diagonal. So it's got a little bit of a learning curve, but it's actually a pretty easy game to jump in on. It was super fun. Reminded me of everything I liked about Fuse without the sort of timeline pressure. And reminded me of what I liked about sort of dice drafting games like Sushi Go. So, and it's also a very pretty game. There's all these different colored dice, and you make a stained glass window.
That's cool.
And I really recommend this.
I do appreciate games that have strong aesthetics like that. Like Carcassonne is an obvious one where you build a neat-looking, cool map every time.
Yeah. So definitely recommend Sagrada. And I believe that's all we got this week.
Hold on, sir.
Oh.
I just thought we'd just do a real quick touch base with Star Trek Discovery.
Why? Do you not talk about that every week on your podcast?
My podcast, Text Trek?
That's it.
The ironic thing, of course, is I opened rather cold to it,
yeah.
But I thought that this one would be worth mentioning because, in a way, it's the true pilot of it.
It is.
It's the first time that Lieutenant Commander Michael Burnham, after the disastrous prologue two episodes, she's been in prison, and she ends up being kind of shanghaied, really, to the Discovery. And so we meet the ongoing crew, and you get all the sort of
Captain Lorca,
played by Jason Isaacs. Isaacs?
Yep.
Yeah.
Her quirky sort of roommate, who was actually one of the few characters that I kind of immediately liked, because a lot of the other ones are kind of... I liked Lorca, but he's not like a character who I would ever want to hang out with.
He's got a little sinister vibe to him.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Her roommate seemed a little bit more of a quirky, slightly maybe on the spectrum kind of gal.
Yeah, I think that was deliberately done, yeah.
Whose cheerfulness was completely a departure from her... What's her name? Burnham. She looks like shell-shocked and dead inside from her time in prison. Man, and from
Sonequa Martin-Green is so good in this role.
She's doing great. So she, you know, in her heart of hearts, believes she may have, triggered a war, been responsible for the death of her captain.
I wanted to ask you about this, because people keep saying, you know, all these things she caused, and like, First Officer Saru is very mad with her, that kind of thing.
Right.
He's forgiven her to some extent, but he also, you know, blames her. What did she actually do to cause the war? Is this sort of a narrative that's unfolding? Because she didn't really do anything. I mean, she committed a mutiny. That's fair.
She did kill T'Kuvma.
She did kill T'Kuvma.
Yeah.
Okay, that's true.
But she killed the guy who was unifying the house.
She actually did do something to cause it.
Yes, she did, but in the grand scheme of things...
It might have happened.
Right.
She didn't know that. She is kind of so, I think, crushed by the general weight of everything happening.
Well, the guilt of her captain being killed.
Yeah, that she is... chosen in a way to take the guilt on herself.
Yeah, she's chosen it.
It's like she's... It's in some ways a sort of self-pitying hopelessness.
Right.
I can't kind of put the noose around saying that she killed 8,605 people.
Right.
Or whatever.
168.
Something
like that.
Because the Klingons wanted war.
Yeah.
And I think they were going to have war regardless.
That was sort of my question, but I'd forgotten about the fact that she basically martyred T'Kuvma. Yeah,
she did switch her phaser to kill. They were specifically trying to capture her.
Yeah.
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 But she did it right after T'Kuvma killed Michelle Yao's character.
This has been compared to Battlestar Galactica, which I think is a fair comparison. It's darker. Yeah. Galactica had that like 3-hour movie that started things.
Yeah.
And this did the same thing. The Discovery, like the pilot that we saw, the two first episodes, they're essentially a mini movie that sets up the world.
Right. It would function as the Galactica movie.
Dude. Yeah.
I did see it interestingly suggested that this could have truly been the first episode.
Yeah.
Where you are left with some sort of mysteries that would be unveiled in the next episode or two or through flashbacks. Like, how did she become this disgraced mutineer? You know, why was she in prison?
I wouldn't have liked that as well.
Their notion was that you could then, you could do more with Michelle Yeoh's character by having more flashbacks to their past and stuff. But I kind of like that idea better because the character fireworks of seeing her alongside the other crew members, which also includes the science dude who's the astromycologist, the fungus expert,
Lieutenant Stamets,
who is named after a real mycologist who is also in this fictional context kind of a jerk.
Yeah,
but
I just remember that
he was an interesting jerk and sort of a moral guy who's been sort of pressed into service. it was pointed out. Well, Nick, you finish your thought, and then I'll finish my thought.
No, I was just going to say that actor has been around for a long time. He was in Adventures in Babysitting, and he also was in...
Was he?
He was one of the guys in Dazed and Confused. Huh. And it's just like seeing him as this kind of micro... What is he?
Astromycologist.
Astromycologist.
Yeah. But he's a kind of stuffy science guy who you better keep up with or he's going to get pissed kind
of
guy.
He's great. I actually really like
him. But he was great. I believe Nicholas Meyer, who directed Star Trek II, I can't remember if he's like an executive producer on the show. And it was pointed out, like, aside from the fact that Khan is in many ways, even though it's not a wartime movie, it feels like it is. They are as if they are at war throughout the whole movie.
Yeah.
But also Kirk's son David, who co-created like the Genesis device, which is the big MacGuffin in the Star Trek II and III for that matter.
Yep.
He was specifically worried about science being the pawn, scientists being pawns of the military. In fact, that's why he hated Kirk when he showed up, because he thought he was coming there to steal the Genesis device from under them.
Right.
That is for sure a kind of a thematic quality that's going on here too.
That is all the Trek fans I've seen really seem happy about this. That I say, IO9 wrote a piece that Starfleet has always had this thing of, well, are you scientists? Are you for exploration? Are you like the defense fleet of the Federation? And the answer is they're both.
Right.
But that conflict of destroyer versus explorer...
Right. Is pushed to the fore here.
Has never been explored in quite this way, and I think that's interesting.
Right. Now, there is a part of me that is still strongly resisting the show because it is so dark.
Yeah.
This episode had new levels of sort of violence for a Trek show, and the crew, when they go over to their sister ship, and there's those guys who have been through...
It was like a horror movie.
Yeah, it's like what was the movie that not Pitch Black. What's the one that had Sam Neill in it?
Event Horizon.
It was like Event Horizon weirdness with guys whose like bodies were distorted.
There was some body horror
deformed by something.
And then
there
was also a Resident Evil type monster,
a creature loose that. They seem to be a little mysterious about exactly how it related to that. Like, it had clearly killed the Klingons that got on the ship, but I don't think it had caused those weird... No. That was their own experiments.
Here's what I think. I think they're doing multiple experiments.
Yeah.
They were both doing... And the Discovery still is.
Yep.
And I believe that basically they are building weapons, despite what the captain tells Burnham at the end.
Right.
I liked the tone. I was like, I've never seen them do sort of true, like, space horror in Star Trek. I thought they did that well. There's a question of... it's a big coincidence if Michael Burnham is actually like there was an accident that got her to Discovery. I believe that the implication is that Lorca actually like sicked those parasites on the ship after it changed course,
right?
And basically brought her aboard and then tested her by having her fight the other inmates. Basically,
absolutely seemed like he was manipulating those events. It was certainly hinted at.
Do you think he killed that pilot? Because I have a feeling that pilot was in on it and they like tractor beamed her up.
It was weird that they didn't address it.
I think they might at some point. I think what's going to happen is at some point she's going to find out, he's going to confront her, and he's going to be like, oh, that pilot's on board the ship still.
They're not addressing a lot of stuff, and I kind of like the mystery of it.
Well, like the actual nature of Lorca is tough to see. He kind of talks Burnham into signing up with him at the end by talking a sort of a good game about how they're using military applications of this kind of crazy science right now, but that it could have such amazing real science, hard science applications.
Yeah. And then...
And I'm like, does he mean that? but you're talking about the very end
And then
thing?
We see his crazy menagerie of like with a Gorn skull. And,
right. It is almost as if he's like Dr. Moreau.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see.
I think he's going to be both. I think he is a military man. I think he's maybe a scientist with loose ethics.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he did believe every word he told her. I think he is going to be a complicated character.
That's the interesting test of it.
And I feel like if you put that on Jason Isaacs' shoulders, that's something he can handle because he's a fantastic actor.
Also, that dude keeps a tribble in his office.
Yeah,
because the whole time he's talking to her, I'm hearing that sound, and I'm like, That's like a tribble.
Yep.
Like, I don't know Star Trek that well, but I know that's what a tribble sounds like. And then the next time you saw it, like, you could see a tribble, and I'm like, that is not a great idea.
No. I have this feeling that at some point, if they decide that they need this guy to be a bad guy, he's going to, like, in anger, just kill that tribble or something.
I think a different way, because you know Brian Fuller and his weirdness.
Yeah.
I think they're going to do an homage to a Tribbles episode.
Well, you know, there is a slight trick to this. In Kirk's time, when they had the Tribbles episode, nobody knew about Tribbles.
Yeah.
So it kind of can't be, unless this whole crew is going to die, which is easily possible.
Yeah.
Because this is a very unpredictable show.
Well, I think that's the thing. I think the Discovery, by its nature, is going to be something that does not have a huge impact on the Star Trek universe going forward, because they have a Gorn skull, which was also first encountered at Star Trek. They have,
but they could be essentially Black Ops and essentially sworn to secrecy. Like, hey, we resolved our mission, and maybe it goes well, and maybe it goes bad or whatever. But they're like, you can't talk about this with anyone.
Well, like, and the Myconid technology, wherever that goes, it doesn't exist even in the Next Generation time that we know of. So, Black Ops, they have black badges, they have black alerts, which we've never heard of before, which. It's on the verge of being dumb.
Yeah.
But I thought it was cool.
Actually, I thought the black symbols were pretty cool.
Some people, there was an obvious wondering if they might be, sort of tied into Trek's secret age, what would you call them? Their secret intelligence division of...
the IMF.
Yeah, they're, what do they call it? Something 13.
Bureau 13?
Bureau 13.
Something like that.
Or 31, 31. Section 31.
Section 31, yeah.
I think that's it.
I don't know if you're referring to this. I don't know it, but...
And my own Trek knowledge is not deep enough to be able to talk a lot about it. They, but those guys are so subversive and secretive, they would not wear badges, anything that could be identified, unless they thought they were all going to kill everybody at the very end.
But here's the thing I think is interesting. This, the Black Fleet, the other stuff... The worry, I think, with this is that it was not going to be Star Trek enough, that it might be, trying to distance itself. But they're putting in some deep Easter eggs for some Star Trek people.
Yeah,
and as well as doing a show that is accessible to people who've never watched Star Trek, because one of my friends, Grant, is doing a Star Trek podcast, and he has never really watched much Star Trek, and he is super into this because it's such good TV.
You know what's... although it is a very dark show, there were funny moments, occasionally darkly funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know when she's the quarters that when she they finally bring Burnham onto the ship, and the roommate shows up and she's kind of nervously, kind of almost cheery, but definitely kind of nervous.
Yeah.
And she asks about her name, and she hears it, Michael Burnham, and she's like, "Oh, she's like, that's crazy. That she's like, is that really your name?" She's like, "The only Michael Burnham I've ever heard of is the mutineer, the traitor."
Yeah.
And then she's like, "You're not that person, right?" And then she's like, "Oh." Oh.
Yeah, there's also the Klingon, did he just shush me?
Yeah,
which cracked me up.
And is it just a minor note, just because it's not a first time in the movies, but definitely first time in the TV shows, playing with their ratings a little bit, because Burnham does say shit at some
point. That's right, it's true.
Which is kind of what you say, I think, when you have a what looks like a tardigrade that's the size of a rhinoceros chasing after
Actually,
you.
And just as a weird thing, I liked the Alice in Wonderland, the book. And,
I have issues with the way it was done, and I would have done it a different way, but I saw what they were doing.
Yeah.
And also, that's a nod to Spock's mom.
Yeah,
so we
that's
know
what
that.
I was...
Yeah.
That was the bigger thing. I'm like,
we already knew that she, of course, was the ward of Sarek, but exactly whether how well she was known to Spock's mom was a bit of a mystery, and at least until now. Still somewhat mysterious,
but apparently she was at least raised alongside Spock, which is interesting.
Yep.
Which leads me to believe... They're going to bring him in at some point?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think they will.
We'll see. It's going to be hard to resist.
And just sort of this, discovery, I mean...
He's a science officer. If he were to come by at one point...
I mean, are they...
Now, if he's not, if he finds out what's going on... Kind of pursue it.
Yeah.
But there's lots of things you could do on tangents, or you could have, especially since they seems to at least have the potential to travel anywhere.
Yeah.
So they could be behind enemy lines one episode, and then they could be back in Federation territory. Yeah. They could meet. The two of them could meet at a starbase and just talk about what's going on.
Yeah.
And she wouldn't have to. She'd be like, "Well, I can't say anything about what's going on."
Right.
So you would only get the sort of personal side of it.
Well, and also this is. I mean, they are doing this as a big 13 episode, or 15 episode series. Because those two ones are a bonus, I found that out.
Oh, interesting.
So, but it is also going to be... I mean, it seems like they are maybe do a little episode of the week type stuff. We're going to have Harry Mudd and that kind of thing.
Yep.
And they mentioned here that... Can it run 31 scientific operations at the same time or something?
Right.
So, different experiments could lead to an episode of the week. There could be an experiment that Spock finds out or is involved.
So far, it's been pretty closely mythology episodes tied together. I heard a crazy theory that I'll just throw out there. That I guess that the Brian Fuller's original desire was to do a series that would be an anthology series that could be set in all these different Trek eras.
Yeah.
Somebody was wondering if this technology they're developing
it's like a time travel
could also be work as a time travel, and if they are the dawn of Section 31, They could be trying to be quiet in any era they go to.
Oh, that'd be cool if actually the big reveal
is the stealth show is that they are going to actually do that.
Season 2, they could do Next Generation.
Cause right, or they could be slipping into DS9 or Enterprise or whatever.
That would explain why the technology is not known.
Right.
Oh, that would be the coolest thing ever.
Yeah, now I think this is probably an out there idea, but like the basics of it could be...
Well,
and they've been real cagey with their secrets. Like, everybody...
Yeah.
Before the show came out, we did find out that there was something weird going on with this fungus, and it had something to do with their technology.
Yeah.
But they only, in the third episode, kind of revealed the mission of the Discovery.
That makes so much sense, because it makes sense why, like, how he went from an anthology series to Discovery.
Yeah.
If the Discovery premise had anthology built into it.
Right. Like, you know, why was 10 years before Kirk's time so appealing to him? Yeah. I'm like, there's nothing super special going on there.
And people have said, they're like, there's no reason why the Klingons, you know, like, this makes more sense as a post-Next Generation show, because just substitute a different race for the Klingons, and all of this still works, and you don't have to worry about the continuity issues.
Yeah.
And what they've gained from being before Kirk really isn't, I mean, her being tied to Spock...
They get a little bit of to play a little with the sandbox
of
Star Trek.
But it's not that important to sort of have to deal with all the continuity.
Yep.
But if it's a time travel show, then it sort of makes sense why they did. I mean, I like this theory a lot.
Yeah, well, get ready to be disappointed when it doesn't happen. But,
like a Legion theory?
Yeah, it could be one of those things. But I imagine they'll be real cagey about it up until they decide to run with it. So, like... I feel like it's the kind of thing that it becomes. It's the series finale, season finale, or the start of season two. But just something to keep in mind.
Yeah. All right, that's it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. And until that time,
yo, Joe.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.